Welcome. Thank you so much for your service.
Yikes. Whew. Wow. I probably need that. I'm good. Yeah, I think I'm all right. Hi, everybody. I'm Tony. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me? Sort of. Oh, my God. Oh, there's a lot of people here. Okay. I'm grateful to be here and be here with you guys tonight. I'll start with welcome to the new people, anyone who did or did not identify. I'm glad that you're here. I hope that you find here what I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Congratulations to the token takers, ladies. This is beautiful. Man, 2 years. Whatever, I had to write them down because I don't remember anything at all. 39 years, Doris, Barb, 49 years. Oh, what a gift, man. I don't know about you, but when I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea what I was in store for. I'm just curious, how many people are in their first year? Oh man, you guys have no idea. No idea what you are in for. You have no idea what happens if you stick around here, how your life is going to change and what can and will happen for you in your life, in your family's life, in the lives of the people around you. I have to say, I think thank you to John for getting in touch with me, who got my number from Suzanne, who got my number from Andres at the Bridge Group, and I don't know how that happened from John. Anyways, that's how I landed here to be with you guys tonight. And I have some friends who came here tonight to support me. I have Phil's here and Richard's here, Mary Beth and Joe and Kent, and some other people are here. Manny's here and some of his friends, and Tony's here, and I'm super nervous. I don't want to go, I'm scared. So I have to take notes because I don't remember anything. I am an alcoholic. I didn't know what it meant to be alcoholic until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and actually I didn't get here directly. I found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at 23 years old, compliments of a 5150 into a psych facility at 23 years old. Yeah, it was pretty sweet. So I'm going to jump around a little bit. So not only am I an alcoholic, I have to have full disclosure. I'm a coke fiend. I'm a tweaker. Pop some pills. I smoke a lot of weed every now and then. Do all that stuff. I'm also a cutter. I have relationships with food. All kinds of stuff. I found my home and I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous because I always had a bottle. I would have other things periodically, but I always had a bottle, and I can't even remember. I don't want to remember, but I can feel how it felt in that apartment all by myself, wanting to die at 23 years old. And my body was absolutely coming apart because I was poisoning myself over and over and over again, and reviving myself the next day. I want to back up a little bit. This is not going to be chronological at all. I'm not capable of that at all. So hang on, and I'm going to go from here to here. And by the way, my friends may have some kind of a gambling thing going on here, an over-under on how long it's going to take me to cry and how many times I'm probably going to cry, because when I talk about my recovery, so here it is. When I talk about my recovery, it moves me. It means the world to me that I'm here, because I shouldn't be here. I mean, I should be, because I am. And I know that that's the will. That's the doing of my higher power. So I grew up in Los Angeles. My mom and dad were married for over 61 years. I was adopted as a child, as an infant. There's a whole side story about me learning about my biological side of my family when my mom passed away almost 6 years ago. And I don't know if I'm going to have time to get into that. What time am I done? Nine. Okay, I might. We'll see. But had a sister too. She's a little older than me. So we were both adopted. We were not related. And a great house, great family. My father was a World War II vet. And he became a teacher after that. And my mom was a nurse. They were both born East Coast. They moved out here. They met out here. Wonderful family. We didn't want for anything. I was raised. It was lovely. We had our family home for over 50 years. Walking away from that home when my mom passed and we sold that house and Phil was with me was a hard thing to do, but I was grateful to be there. But I remember as a child, some people might relate to this. I remember as a child feeling weird. I was a weird kid. I was an ugly kid. I had buck teeth. My dad called me Beaver, which was really cool for a young lady to be called Beaver. By your father. He wasn't trying to hurt me. I wasn't trying. I think wasn't trying to, belittle me. It was cute. My sister got the name Tiger, which was way better than Beaver. I was chubby. I was an ugly kid. My mother hates me for saying that. And I was smart. Apparently back then, they were testing us as we were going into school, and I was mentally gifted. So all my life, I was told I was special. Find out when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys tell me I'm not special and I'm not different at all. I'm just like all of you. That was different. I didn't want to be special or different. I just wanted to be like everybody else, and I wasn't. And I just didn't feel right. I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. I didn't want to be with these people. I wanted to be with those people. And I just looked at all the pretty girls, all the pretty girls in here. And I went, I want to be with them. I want to be like them. I don't want to be smart. I don't want to be special. I don't want to be any of this. I don't want to play concert piano. I didn't want any of that. But that's what I did. That's what I was given. That's what was handed to me. And I didn't really have a choice. Because this is what I was supposed to do. My sister was average, so she didn't have a lot of expectations put on her. And I don't know what that had to do with anything, but I feel like it had something to do with it. But when the opportunity rose for me, probably about 15-ish, 14, 15 years old, to dabble in some things. So we had my dad, he was a sailor. He was, 37 years of collective active and reserve duty in the Navy, retired a command master chief, and had a second career as an educator, and what a good man he was. I'll never meet a better man than my dad. He was strict. They were strict. I had a strict household. I hated that, too. My friends could go do whatever they wanted, and I didn't get to do anything. But when I had the opportunity, eighth grade, we went camping at down here in San Alejo Park or something. We came down from Los Angeles and we had a bottle of Jack, and I was in the eighth grade, and I took one pull off that thing, and my dad had beer all the time, and he'd have me crack them open. I'd shake them. Remember those cans you had to pull the tops off, right? And I'd shake the beer, and I thought that was funny. Sometimes he thought it was funny, but other times he did not. And I took one pull off that Jack bottle, and we all sat around, and we got caught, and we got suspended from school. And I was kind of excited about that, because that might be gave me a little bit of credit of some sort. I don't know. My parents were mortified. How could this happen to Tony, this perfect child, right? And I was excited about that. My mother was like, "You're just going to have to hold your head high, Tony." And I was like, "Okay, Mom." But I was kind of glad that it happened. And from that point on, any opportunity I had to maybe dabble in. And by the time I got into high school, which was 10th grade where I was, it was already on. And I somehow managed from going to be complete straight-A student in advanced classes to not graduating from high school because I was smoking and drinking. We kept a bong in a boot and a bottle of Jack in the back, and that's what we did. Every morning we sat out in the cars with a bong and a bottle of Jack in the back, and I don't know how they didn't know. I mean, I had a creative writing class, and I wrote stories, and I was really, really drunk. And then they had to pass the stories around, and other people had to make comments about them. And somebody wrote, "Tony's on acid," or something like that. I wasn't, but I was a really good writer. I was very creative. I graduated at 17 years old, and I left the house. And at that point, everything just really went sideways for me. I got to a point very quickly that I could not drink. And I moved in with some guy that I hardly knew, and I married him. And because my parents said, if you're going to live together, you should be married, because that's what you should do as a good young lady. And I was like, okay, if that's what you'll get, we'll get you off my back. So I married this guy. And at that point, I hadn't gone into any other kind of white powder or anything like that, but that's what they did. So then I started dabbling in that. I remember I heard a gal at a meeting the other night. She said to me, she was talking and she says, I didn't know where my life was going or what I was going to do. And I said, I sat down at 17 years old with a bong and a beer and I thought, oh, this is it for the rest of my life and I'm going to be so happy. I mean, right? That's all I needed to do and I was going to be so happy. And that didn't happen. And in the next however many years from that, from 17 to 23 years old, it got bad and it got bad fast. I became a club girl for a little while. I don't know how I drove. I don't know how I walked. I don't know how many dangerous situations I put myself in with strange men and cars and things. And I don't know if anybody can relate to that, ladies or gentlemen. Manny, I know. God, and the shame and the guilt and the things that grew around that. So I had this little shitty apartment that by myself. And all I could do by the time, the last year and a half, 2 years, was I managed to get up and go to work. I kept a job, but all I could do was go to that job, come home, and I shut the door, shut the windows, shut everything, and just stay in that room, that little apartment by myself. My body was starting to just kind of disintegrate. I wasn't eating. Vodka at that point was my drink. I would walk over to the 7-Eleven because across the street from my apartment building, I'd wrap my snake around my neck so people would stay away from me because people are scared of snakes. And I had a boa constrictor, so that would keep people away from me. It worked. So if you want, that works if you need that. He was wonderful. I got to this point at 23 years old. I had kind of just stayed away from my family just because I was so embarrassed and so ashamed. And I knew my parents didn't love me anymore. I knew that. So one of the things that I know today is all those things that I knew, so absolute, right, were just things that were manufactured in my head. There were things that I made up because of the guilt and the shame that I was feeling. And I knew the way that I was living was bad and wrong and it was going to kill me. I knew it, but I couldn't stop. And I didn't know that I couldn't stop because I didn't know that I had some obsession of the mind and allergy of the body. I didn't know any of that. How do you know that stuff? You don't. I just know that I couldn't stop doing what I was doing. I'd heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, one of my dad's best friends, his wife, she was a rip-roaring alcoholic. She was a hot mess, this lady. I felt sorry for her. She was just terrible. But I wasn't anything like her. Nothing like her. It was February? March. Well, my sobriety date's March 7th, 1989. So I have to back into that number. So it was February of 1989. And one of the things I did with my dad that was our thing to do was we'd go to the horse races. He raised me at Santa Anita Park and Hollywood Park when it existed, and Del Mar. And we would go, he'd say, you want to have a date with your dad? And I said, yeah, we'd go to the horse races. So I've been betting on horses and reading a racing form since I was like 3 years old. And I did not watch the Preakness today, though. Sorry. Santa Anita Handicap was coming up. 2 weeks before that, I was at my job. And this was 89. I was working for a city government. And this was just when employee assistance programs were kind of a new thing. And lady came to me, and one of the HR ladies came to me, and she could tell that there was something, like I was not okay, clearly. And she sat me down and she wanted to talk to me. She was worried about me. And for some reason, I opened up to this lovely lady. Her name was Cindy. And I remember I can see her. And I told her that I felt awful and I was going to kill myself. And that's how I felt. And that's what I wanted to do. And I don't know, whatever possessed me, and I so regretted that later. But in that moment, sitting with this woman who seemed to really care about me, she seemed to really care. She wanted to know. She said she wanted to help me, and I believed her. And she did help me. I told her I wanted to die. And Cindy had to do something with that information. I didn't know that. So the next thing I know, I'm being put on some kind of a leave, and I'm told that I have to mandatorily go see a psychiatrist, and I have to do this and this and this, and I'm off for 2 weeks. And I'm like, what just happened? How am I going to explain this to anybody? But I do, and I go see this psychiatrist, and he wants to put me in a program. And I'm like, I don't need that. And he goes, I think we need to put you into a program. And I said, listen, I promise you, I'm okay. It's okay. I won't drink. I promise. He put me on, I don't know what he put me on. I want to say something, trazodone or whatever. And I promise I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to use. I promise I won't. I promised. And I think for 4 or 5 days, I did not. I just stayed home and I just didn't do anything. Whatever you do, detox, right? But then somebody made me angry. And so you pick up the phone and you go to the store, and what do? You start all over again. And about 2 weeks had gone by. I went back to work, and I don't know, somebody looked at me sideways, and it was on again. We went to the horse races we always went for my mom's birthday. It was the Santa Anita Handicap, and I came home, and I came to one more time on March 7th that morning. And I looked in the mirror, and I sat in that chair in that crappy apartment. I smoked a pack of cigarettes. I cut myself up, cut my arms up. I didn't drink. I didn't use. I didn't do anything like that. And I knew that. So that 2 weeks prior to that, I took a bunch of pills and I tried to kill myself with a bunch of pills. And obviously that failed. My girlfriend managed the building, and she came in about a day and a half later or whatever, knocked on the door, couldn't find me, came in, and she's like, what happened? Oh, I drank too much. It's not a big deal. I'm fine. I didn't tell anybody what happened. But that day, I sat there, and I had made a decision that I was either going to kill myself and I was going to succeed, or I was going to ask for help. Now, I didn't know anything about a moment of clarity, or I didn't know what that meant. I had never heard that term before. I didn't know about a higher power. I didn't know anything. All I knew was that I could no longer live the way that I was feeling. I could not. I was miserable. I hated who I was. I hated who was in the mirror. I hated how I thought, how I felt. And I absolutely knew that I was a burden to everybody around me. I knew it. It was a fact. Nobody said that to me, but I knew it was true, and that everybody was going to be better off if I was gone. I knew it. And for some reason, what I know today, what a gift we get when we come in here, hindsight, retrospect, we get to look back at things that happened so long ago, or maybe just last week, and didn't know why something happened, and get to go, oh my God, now I know why that happened. There was a purpose there. There was something that was supposed to happen, and that's why that happened, because I did this, and this is what I was supposed to do, but I didn't know that, but that's what I did, and that's why it happened. And I picked up the phone and I called my mom. And Tony, in my, oh my, sick, poisoned, wanna die, like I don't belong here anymore, how I was, I did not have the capacity to do that. I know that that was my higher power, what I call my higher power now, working in my life, that picked up that phone, and I called my mom, and I said, Mom, I need help or I'm going to die. And my mom helped me get help. So I get 5150'd into this psych facility that's in downtown Los Angeles off of College near Chinatown. They call an ambulance, they pick me up, pack a bag. I go to this place. It's a dank, dirty, old, like, you know, like, I mean, this is in 1989 there. I don't know how they are now, but it was not fancy. And it was a psych facility. So there was all kinds of people going on and things going on there. So they take me through the lockup unit downstairs, the guy, and I'm looking around and there's people and they're screaming and they look crazy. They were crazy people. And I looked at this guy and I went, you know, I think I might have jumped the gun just a little bit. I think I'm all right. I looked at him square in the eye. I think I'm all right. I don't need to be here. Can I get a ride home? He just looked me straight in the eye. He said, nope, you got 72 hours to think about it. Then you can decide. So they marched me into my little room with the plastic over the mattress that's this thick and take away my stuff. And I'm part of the chemically dependent crowd now. There's like 8 of us and there's all kinds of other people there for various things. And that's where I had my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. True introduction. They brought an H&I panel in. And thank God for H&I. I've done some H&I work and I just love it. God, what a lifesaver. I didn't know that, obviously, then. But I love doing H&I work. I've had the honor and the pleasure of doing a few different panels. And God, how rewarding is that? How rewarding and wonderful is it? So we go in, I think it was day 3. So I'm still a mess, right? And we go in, and I sit down, and I'm like with an attitude. And these two guys come in. They start talking about, oh, this higher power and the book and the this and the that. And they've lost businesses and money and cars and boats and families and houses. And their lives have become better because of Alcoholics Anonymous and these steps that they've taken. And I'm sitting there going, I don't have anything in common with these guys. I don't have a boat. I don't have any money. I don't have a house. They're old. They're like 35 years old. I have nothing in common at all with these people. Nothing. I just sat there. But then they started talking about the mess that's happening up here, this stuff that's happening in here, this loudness, this ugliness that happens in here, and that big hole that happens right in here. That thing that happens right here, right? Oh. And how this worked for them. How taking these steps helped them make a connection. How doing this inventory, what the hell is that inventory? How they went through this process and it changed their lives. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? And they described it. They described what it meant to have a sponsor, somebody who's going to guide you through this process. A sponsor, that means somebody, I mean, we can't give away something we don't have, right? I can't transmit something I haven't got. That's what our book says, and that's true, right? I can't take somebody through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous if I've never done them. I can't fix a car if I've never fixed a car before. I mean, I could try, but good luck. And they talked about this stuff, and it made sense to me. I thought, wow, these guys who I just thought were like, I got nothing in common with these guys. They started talking about this. And I thought, maybe there's a chance. I've always believed in God. I mean, I've always believed that there's a higher power. My higher power, I'll tell you what, it doesn't look like anything in particular. My sponsor, Margaret's been my sponsor for over 15 years, and her sponsor, Betty's 50, I'm 59 years old, which means Betty's 58 years sober, because she got sober the year after I was born. And Betty's amazing. And we were having, I'm sorry, I'm going on a little side tangent here. We do a women's, we talk Zoom every 2 weeks and we read. We read every single book there is. Right now we're reading Marty Mann's story, which is fascinating, by the way. But we're talking about meditation. And one of the other girls, she's like, I can't meditate. My brain won't be quiet. I can't do it. And Betty says to her, Betty's tiny and she's so wise. She's just wonderful. She says, she's 96 years old, I think. Oh, she's crazy. Anyway, she's like, what are you doing when your mind goes quiet? And Michelle goes, I think I'm gardening. Like my hands are in the soil and I'm playing with the dirt and planting things. And she goes, Tony, what are you doing when your mind goes quiet? And I'm like, ask him. My mind is not a quiet place ever. But most quiet my brain gets is when I'm sitting outside or I'm walking outside. I have to be outside usually. And I'm just listening and looking at nature. I'm a birder. This weekend before was a big global birding day, by the way. We did a great job of catching different species around San Diego. That's another tangent. Birding, watching birds, listening, noises, looking. And that's when my mind goes quiet. I've been at a meeting outside sitting in the middle of talking, just like I am right now, where I heard something and I'm in the middle of talking and everybody's like, what is she doing? And Janine's like, oh, she heard a bird. I'm like, that was a spotted towhee. Anyways, but that's when my mind got quiet. But we talked about that in that women's group and meditation. They talked about how we can quiet our minds and learn to control that racing, I'm somebody else here has to have a brain like this. It's ADHD, it's can't remember CRS, can't remember stuff. I'm a big hot mess. Like I'm walking over here with something, I set it down, feels like, what are you doing with this? I'm like, oh, it's a half an hour later. You know, oh, I meant to put it over there. It's terrible, which is why I have notes, which I haven't even looked at, by the way. So that's good. It's a good thing I wrote them down. Now where was I at? What was I talking about? Meditation. Thank you, Betty, and the meditation. So these guys talked about all kinds of things that I had never heard of, and I thought maybe this thing can work for me. So I stayed in that place, I think, about 13 days. I don't know. My dad came, and he took me out on the weekend, and he took me to my apartment, and we had to clean it out. We had to clean it out of everything. Bottles and pipes and wrappers and all that stuff. We had to clean it out, and I didn't catch it all. There was some. I lived alone, by the way, but I hid my stuff because when you're like us, you got sketchy friends, and so there's some of it that I didn't find until later. But my dad came over and helped me do that. And I always thought of myself as, when I was out there, that I thought, like, you know, like, I'm solo, I'm unique, right? I'm going to be unique, I'm self-sufficient, and I'm a strong, independent woman. And really, really, what I was is I was scared, and I was disconnected. And I masked all that with these big, fancy words, and I was really just frightened. I was frightened that people weren't going to like me. I was frightened that I wasn't going to be accepted because I never felt that I was when I was younger. And I masked all that with these substances that did two things. Made me not care, first of all. And second of all, gave me some sense of belonging with people who were doing the same thing that I was doing. Today is so different for me. You guys told me when I got here that if I wanted something I've never had and if I wanted to be and live a certain way that I've never lived before, I had to do things that I've never done before, right? And I've done a lot of things I've never done before in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love every single one of them. I've taken those steps, and I sponsor some women. I actually sponsor one gentleman too. I use the word gentleman. You can tell him that, okay, Manny? Thank you. I seem to go through life with this idea that and getting angry at things were so seemingly unfair and to me, and that people didn't care. It was like manufactured outrage. I could be mad at anyone about anything at any time, and it was all made up. All of the things that I felt, I came to realize doing inventory and looking back at my life and my childhood and all of the things that I believe to be true, I truly believe those things. No one ever told me any of that. I was told that I was loved. I was cared for. My parents adored me. I mean, they were such beautiful people. And they never said those things to me. But I believed it. I made that up. That's how I felt in here. And I don't know where that came from. I don't know where that came from. Someone suggested that it came from me being adopted. Real quick, I'm going to tell you about that. My mom died. It'll be 6 years on May 26th that my mom passed away. When my mom died, my sister found envelopes about our adoption information. I just knew I was adopted my whole life. I was adopted as an infant, and my sister was, well, she's a little older than me. In those papers was a communication between my parents' attorney at the time in 1964, 65. I was born in 1965, so 65, 66. And the LA County of Adoptions. And on every one, it said, regarding the adoption of, and it was redacted. There was a name there, and it had been redacted. The last piece of paper that I opened, the last envelope that I opened, it was not redacted. So the name that I was given at birth was on there. And I took that name and I put it into a search engine, and that led me to my biological half-sister. So long story short, if I can, is that my biological mother was 42 years old when she had me. She had four other children. She had been married and divorced already four times. And that's what I knew. My oldest sister was 20 years older than me, my oldest sibling. And what I came to find out is that there was my oldest sister, then there was a brother, two more sisters, and then me. 20 years between the oldest and the youngest. The three in the middle, all dead from drugs and alcohol. And I learned that because I wrote, her name was Linda, my oldest sister. She's still living. She lives in Joshua Tree. I wrote her a letter. I told her who I was and why I thought we were connected. And I still have her voicemail message on my phone from 2019 when she called me and she said, yes, Tony, we're sisters. We're half sisters. And when we went to see her, I asked what happened. What happened to the others? What happened to my brother and my other sisters? And she said they all died from drugs and alcohol. Him in his 50s, one in her 30s, one in her 40s, they all died from drugs and alcohol. And when we were driving home, Phil looked at me and he's like, you're like a science experiment. Like that whole argument of environment versus genetics, right? And I was like, what would have happened to me if she had not put me up for adoption? And I said that to Margaret, my sponsor. She's like, oh, honey, you'd be dead. She's like, you had parents who were loving and caring, and you went down that path that was genetically predisposed, clearly, to go down that path. You made a choice to try and ask for help. You went to your mom, you said, Mom, I need help, and she helped you. And you have been successful in that so far. You'd have gone to her, your biological mother, and said, Mom, I need help, if you had gotten even that far. And she'd have handed you a drink and a cigarette and said, good luck, honey. Because she clearly didn't have the aptitude or the ability. I mean, she had already lost three children to the disease of alcoholism and addiction. Anyways, so I had always been grateful to be adopted. I loved my family very much. and I carried a lot of hurt, shame, and guilt about. I didn't get into a whole lot of wreckage. I mean, I was 23 when I got here, so there wasn't a whole lot. I mean, I stole money from my parents and stuff like that, but I mean, I didn't rob any banks or do any crazy stuff. So my amends list was not super intensive, but I think today, so I'm coming here tonight, or before we came here, you know, I was talking to Phil and I was telling him, you know, I'm nervous. I'm nervous because it's really important to me that our responsibility statement is important to me. So I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I didn't know that I had the obsession of the mind and allergy of the body. I didn't know that stuff, but now I know that. And now I know what the solution is for me as an alcoholic. And the solution is Alcoholics Anonymous. The solution is these steps. The solution is in these rooms. The solution is in the exchanges that we have as fellows and being of service and helping each other, right? This is the solution. This is what keeps us here. This is what helps us to grow these new beautiful lives and to be able to walk through life on this whole different plane that is so remarkable. The love that I see in Alcoholics Anonymous transcends any kind of love that I've ever heard of or believed in my whole life. The Greeks call it agape love, which is just a true, pure love of compassion and kindness. And that's what I see and know in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe for me, what I have found is that it's truly all about what I do, my actions. It's about the actions that I take. It's not about what I think about. It's not about what I talk about so much, but it really is what I do, where I show up, the actions that I take. Because I could talk about a lot of stuff, but do I show up? I was on a meeting the other day. I do this international meeting. It's based in South Africa. It started during COVID. Every single day at 9 a.m., that meeting happens. Every single day for 5 years, that meeting has happened. It's crazy. We get 60, 70 people. It's a wonderful meeting. It's called Pied Piper. You can find it online if you want to check it out. But we were talking the other day on that meeting about what it is it means to be in action. And I said, listen, we have to show up. We have to do things. And I said, you know, there's still times in that I don't want to. I want to stay home and sit on the couch and pet my dog. I don't want to go out there. I don't want to. I'm a baby. I don't want to. So I trick myself into showing up places because now I meet a newcomer at a meeting. I always put my hands out. Always. A lot of times, most of the time, hopefully, they welcome it. It's my Sunday morning meeting. I love it. Everybody's very, I'm a hugger. I'll hug everybody if they'll let me. Right? He knows it, too. He's like, I'm going to stand here all night. yeah, we're talking about that. And I'm like, okay, come to the Sunday morning meeting. I'll meet you there. And this is on Thursday. And then Saturday night, I'm like, I don't really want to go. I don't want to get up and go. I told that girl I was going to be there. I got to go. Because I have a responsibility. As a sober woman, I have a responsibility. I made a commitment to her. And I told her I would show up for her. I have to be there because I take that seriously. That matters to me. What happens if I don't show up? I told her I was going to show up there. And what happens if I'm not there? Yeah, who knows, right? Who knows what's going to happen if I don't show up there? Who knows? Maybe she's off. Well, screw her. I'm going to go take a drink. I don't know. If you're new in here, if you haven't lost a friend to this disease yet, and you stick around long enough, you will. And that's just the hard truth. I bet just about everybody in here could raise their hand and say that they've lost somebody that they love to this disease. We bury our friends. I hope when you bury me, you're going to bury me because I'm a sober woman. I'm an old, sober, cranky lady. We don't get to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and be mad about not getting results with when we don't do any work. If you're not doing work and you're bitching about not getting results, you're not going to do that. You got to come in here and do this work. I mean, do it. Sit down with another person. Get into that book. Every chapter is my favorite chapter through the first 164 pages. Doesn't matter which one I'm on. I'm like, ooh. Everybody's like, I know, Tony, it's your favorite. Because it is. And it's highlighted and falling apart. I don't know how many big books I have, but because they fall apart. And every time I read the book, I don't know about you, but there's something different pops out at me. I have circles and stars and frowny faces and all kinds of stuff. Phil was looking at the book with me the other day, and he's like, what is all this stuff? And I'm like, that's how I felt at the moment, you know? And I get really excited about it. I get really excited and fired up about what happens in here. Manny, put your phone down. If that was anybody else, I wouldn't have said anything. Thank you. I love you. If you're new, keep your phone down during the meeting. Is there nothing worse? You know what? For me, I've been sober 36 years. It does not bother me, really, that Manny's on his phone.
It was my sponsor calling me. Oh.
It doesn't matter to me. It doesn't hurt my feelings. I've been around here long enough. But what if somebody new is up here talking at this podium? And he sees people out here, and this person sees people out here going like this, and you're somebody new's up here. How are they gonna feel when they see people not paying attention, like what they have to say doesn't matter? You know, he and I had an hour-long conversation the other day, so, you know.
I apologize.
I know you do, thank you. I'm giving you a hard time, you know that. I had to take the shot. I really just wanted to come here tonight. I'm so grateful to be here, and I know I've been all over the place. I just really wanted to say something that helps motivate or inspire somebody to stay here and to keep doing this thing, because it's beautiful, because it works, because it's powerful, because it's... For me, this is a way of life, and this way of life is truly, it's pure and it's unrivaled from anything that I've seen or heard of. See, for me, I don't know about anybody else, but it's just, you know, as human beings, it's weird. As human beings, we're like the only species that can exist, and we can look over here and we can see things that are good and healthy and beneficial and beautiful. And we can look over here and we can see things that are bad and negative and dangerous and bad. And we can choose this over and over and over again. Like, animals don't do that. They live by instinct. They do what they need to do to survive. And they don't go, oh, she's pretty. Or, oh, that, I'm going here. That's good. That's what I need. I mean, this is needs. This is survival, the good stuff for them. They don't choose this. They do what they need to do. But we choose it. We choose, especially people like us, right? We lose the power of choice if we're alcoholic, but we don't know we've lost the power of choice till we get here. And if you're new, you don't know what you don't know, and you're not gonna know if you don't stay here. Because by staying here, that's how you get to know what you don't know. Right? Does that make sense? Right, you're gonna stay here long enough and you're like, oh my God, that's what I didn't know. That's what happened to me. I didn't know anything. And you guys have taught me so much. You've taught me not to take myself too seriously. I got Rule 62 tattooed on my back. and I do not. I can't. I don't have the energy or the time to take myself too seriously at all, except when I need to be serious, except when I'm doing this. This matters to me. It matters so much to me what happens in these rooms. I had an experience a couple years ago. I want anybody who wants this to find it. I'm not everybody's favorite flavor. That's okay. Nobody is, right? But I don't ever want to be the reason that somebody turns around and walks out a door and doesn't stay at a meeting. I'm not going to be that person. And I was at a meeting, and, you know, we... we're not all here because we're well, right? And somebody walked in the meeting. It was a gentleman who walked in the meeting that had come in and out and in and out and in and out. And was not a lot of bad behavior from this person. Not my favorite. Not my favorite person. Saw him walk through the door, and I went up to him, and I said, "Hey, it's so good to see you." And I put my arms out to give him a hug. And he gave me a big hug. I said, "I'm really glad you're here." And he smiled, and he said, "Thanks, Tony." And we carried on, and we had a meeting. My friend came up to me afterwards and said to me, "Why'd you hug that guy?" I said, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "You don't even like him. You told me you don't even like him." I said, "A, he doesn't need to know that. And B, I want everyone to feel welcome and wanted and loved in these rooms. That's what matters. He doesn't need to know that. Nobody needs to know that." "Well, yeah, they do." "No, they don't. This, you need to work on that." "You need to talk to your sponsor about that, because we don't, they need to, when you were out there, maybe that was something you needed to do. You needed to tell everybody why you didn't like them. People don't need to know that stuff from me anymore. It's not important. It doesn't matter. What matters for me now is that anybody that walks in here feels like they can be here and be safe and welcomed and loved, wanted, welcomed, and loved in these rooms. That's it. That's how I feel about it. I got about 5 minutes. I want to tell you a couple stories about my brain. So, March 20. No, it'd take a lot longer than that. Thank you for pointing that out. I'm gonna give you some cliff notes. So I'm gonna start with this one because this is the one that's high on my mind right now. The anniversary of my mother's death is coming up on the 26th. She'll be gone for 6 years. And she was 92 when she passed, and Phil and I were both with her, holding her hands when she transitioned. And my mother was sick for 5 years. And that started after my dad died. Anyways, so hospice was coming to the house, and they had a nurse come in, and I said, "Mom, the nurse is coming. This is 2 weeks before. This is the day after Mother's Day 6 years ago." And she says, "Okay, Tony." She's all annoyed with me. I said, "Mom, George is coming. He's going to be here at noon." So she's 92 years old. She goes, "I wish it was Georgette." And I said, "Well, it's not. It's George." So George shows up, and she's sitting at the table across from me, and George is sitting here. And she says, he's like, "Okay, Virginia, have you been taking all your medications like you're supposed to?" And she looks at him. "Yes." I said, "No, you're not." "Tony, don't be a snitch." My mother called me a snitch. Like, dead serious. I wanted to laugh. Because it was funny. George is over here trying not to laugh, but it was funny. And I look at George and I'm like, my mother just called me a snitch. She'd never heard that word come out of her mouth before. What are you kidding? She's a proper woman. And George goes, "Virginia, what aren't you taking?" She goes, "I don't know what she's talking about." I said, "She's not taking her iron. She's been anemic her whole life, thalassemia, whatever." And he goes, "Virginia, what was your, whatever that count is?" And she's like, "Oh, it was like 3. And he's like, "You need to take your iron." And she goes, "I can't believe you." So, turns out, after my mom passed, the following year, I buried her with my 30-year token. And when my dad passed, was his funeral was on my sobriety date. On March 7th, it was his funeral at Riverside Memorial with the whole military thing. And I'm not an early morning girl. I never went to 6 o'clock meetings in the morning. And I did that morning. And I told them it was my anniversary. And those people wrapped their arms around me and celebrated me. And I buried my dad with that token that day. And I would have never been able to do anything. I wouldn't have the life that I have today and the friends that I have today who show up for me and who I love and adore and who tell me the truth, people who tell me the truth. And the beautiful women in my life who also, we sit down and we talk, we could talk about anything, but we tell each other the truth and we walk through things. And I get to live with clarity, consciousness, and compassion today. I never thought or knew that I could or wanted to do that, but I do because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm super grateful for the opportunity to be here. I sure hope that somebody got something out of my experience, Strength and Home, tonight. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Tony. That was simply amazing. Let's all give Tony another round of applause. We can also thank the chefs for Cordon Bleu chicken dinner. Thank you, chefs. And we can now circle up and do the prayer of Tony's choice.